all of a sudden, we had the supervisor from C9 say, hey, I need another body. We have this Soviet defector. He claimed he was with a Spetsnaz group, and then he actually described a firefight that he had been involved in Afghanistan. I mean, these were grenades going off. These were people slitting other people's throats, watching his own people die. He's killing people. And you know, the ironic part is the fact that everything he was giving us was going right to the Russians because of this guy Hansen, one of our own.
Who was Kenneth Strain Sr.?
Whoa, that's a great question. So he was my dad, my father, but he was also a pretty interesting man. I kind of think of him as a Renaissance type of person. Loved to read books. Let me put it this way. He was a very different cop, not your typical cop. He was a voracious reader. He liked to do sketches and artwork. He loved sailboats. And, he spent a lot of time on the water when he wasn't working. He was athletic, could crack a joke, was a great singer, great dancer, kind of an actor. I really believe if he had wanted to, he could have ended up in Hollywood or on Broadway. I mean, he was that talented a person, a photographic memory, and an overall great, great father. His life wasn't easy. He had a pretty tough life, and I've only found that out recently.
Are you comfortable diving into it?
I'm not going to go deep into it, but let me put it this way. He had so many challenges in his life. It's a surprise that he got as far as he did. And there was one point in his young life where things could have gone a totally, totally different route, and I probably wouldn't be here today.
And you just recently?
Just recently found out from one of his brothers down in Florida. He kind of opened the Pandora's box, and kind of not surprised because I know some of the family history, but just the fact that he was able to kind of overcome that and then to go on and do great things was, floored. I was floored by that.
So I was going to say, how do you think that changed your outlook on him or your understanding of him? And I guess it's because it's really interesting, beginning of the book, really getting into it.
Yeah.
You see him in such a high level light, which you should.
Yeah.
How do you think that would have impacted if you would have understood that when you were younger?
That's a good question. I guess maybe I would have that much more empathy toward him. Knowing some of that, finding out about that recently, it's another level of complexity in our relationship. And I'm happy he got to where he did. He was just a overall great guy. But I think he approached his family. He approached his family as if he didn't want to repeat some of the things that happened in his past. So it was his mission. This is how I view it. It was his mission to make sure that his family was treated well. Could go on with their dreams, and there was nothing that would sidetrack them. So
diving into his career, he was a part of the NYPD. Can you speak to that a little bit? Both how he rose up through the ranks, some of the challenges you see. I mean, being an NYPD, there's literally nowhere on the planet like that.
Right, right. Yeah, so he was in the military. I think he did 2 years with the U.S. Army, and I know at the tail end of his tenure there, he thought, maybe NYPD would be something he might like to do. So I know he got in, he passed his test. He was, came out with the other cadets or probationary agents or whatever. And it's a funny thing because during the time that they were in training, they were given questionnaires about, what are your talents? What do you like to do? What are your skills? That type of thing. What languages do you speak? Things like that. So he put down that he has a background in singing. And lo and behold, the NYPD had a police glee club. Absolutely. They had a police glee club. So you can imagine, when they're graduating and they're calling out the names, Muldoon, you'll be going to traffic. The other guy, you'll be going to patrol. A strange police glee club.
Wait, how does that work, though?
Yeah, so- he was selected for the glee club. I mean, there was a tryout. They said, okay. So he went, I guess he was with the glee club. They tried out for the glee club, and they said, yes, absolutely. This guy can sing. And he could. He was a great singer. So now he's in the police glee club. And he's, going around New York City, and they're going to all these functions with NYPD, and he's singing. But at the same time, he's also kind of incurring this wrath from some of his colleagues who are saying, yeah. What the hell? This guy is living the life of Riley, and I'm here out in the cold, on the street corner.
Yeah.
But it only lasted 6 months. It lasted 6 months, and then NYPD decided that, they needed more officers on the beat, on the street, so they disbanded the Glee Club. But my father said to me, he said it was a shame they did that because there was kind of an esprit de corps that the police glee club gave. They were out there showing that, not just arresting people or, protecting citizens, but actually, that they had another another face.
Yeah.
Which was a good face.
Did you see the NYPD dance team getting all over social media recently?
I've seen that. Yes, yeah. I've seen that. That's awesome.
Kind of in the same light. Yeah. So that's really interesting. So were they doing normal assignments or if you were a glee club, you were like, that was kind of what you were doing day to day or were you still kind of going in?
No, I think it was day to day. I mean, he would go day to day with the glee club. Mm-hmm. And they had a lot of, I cut out some articles. I found some articles about the police glee club and their last performance and how sad that was for New York City. But there were plenty of performances and he was out there, in all the five boroughs singing his lungs out.
So. We might have to start something trying to bring that back. I'd like to see an NYPD, glee club again versus the dance team. The glee club would be better.
Absolutely.
All right. So, and then they end up getting rid of the Glee Club, and they start moving forward, bringing more detectives on board, bringing more people to just the different parts of NYPD. So I guess, can you speak to it as well? This was at a time where New York City was pretty hot. Like there was a lot of going on. Right. There was kind of, I would imagine at this time, this is when the mafia and other areas were kind of really starting to take hold. What was New York at that period?
I'm just a kid during that period. So I'm really not aware of his job until the 60s, pretty much. And it really, the first time I'm really aware of what's happening with him, I mean, this is a guy that I'd see come home and, you'd see him in his suit and, okay, he's a cop. And, you'd go to cop functions, you go to barbecues and softball games. And, if they needed an extra right fielder, well, they'd even put me in to the game, right? So I knew this world of cops, but I didn't understand the work so much until the riots. These were the Harlem riots in the 60s, like 64. Mm. And that's the first time that, he disappeared for about 2 weeks. We didn't see him. And my mother was just frantic about, what he was doing, where he was. He was in Harlem and, they were raining stones and bottles on him and, some of his people. There. So that's the first time that I said, wow, this is, it's New York City can be turbulent. It's dangerous out there. So and then I remember, I went to a Catholic school and, the nuns at the time were saying, well, these people in Harlem, they have their gripes and, maybe they're unhappy for reasons. And I remember just kind of parroting that back to my mother. I'd come home and I'd say, Mom, these are, the good people over there in Harlem. They're like us. And she just yelled at me and she said, you don't tell me what to do. Your father is out there. He can be killed at any moment. And then what do we do? That type of thing. So I didn't really see that. But yeah, that's the first time that I said, wow, my father is a police officer and he does go into harm's way. You know, as far as the mafia, only later, you know, would I understand that he was doing some plainclothes detective work, like in Brooklyn in the 13th Division, and there was a scandal there. And, you know, this was the numbers game that they had going on there, and all of it was kind of supported by and generated by the mob.
Can you explain the number, like what was happening there a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, you know, these are bets that are placed, you know, on all kinds of, you know, anything from the horses to, you know, you name it, and you know, the mob is taking gets a take from all that. So, you know, his job was to go out there and close down or arrest any people that were doing it illegally, you know, setting up these bookie joints. And I remember that he showed me some flash paper that the bookies were using. So if the cops came through the door, they could just like, you know, put it into an ashtray, would burn, everything would burn. And what are you talking about? What bets? You know, so this was a flash paper that he actually showed me. And he actually came to our high school and gave a talk about his work. But, you know, what's interesting, and this was kind of during the Serpico times as well, where there was a lot of corruption, and he, you know, found himself at that time in with some pretty corrupt cops. They steered clear of him because he had a reputation where he was honest. And even the dishonest cops, he said, actually liked him. And so they actually, you know, and in the end, you know, with the 13th Division scandal, they would do, you know, they'd go to different parks and split up their monies, the pad, they called it, and make sure that Strange was not around, you know. And at the time, you know, in the station house, and I guess you'd have to understand how that worked, you know, these cops put down where they're going, when they're taking vacation, right on the board. So all these bad guys had to do was, where is Strange going to be on that day? Oh, he's vacationing in Maine with his family. Okay, well, that's the day we'll do it, keep them away.
Move from some of the cash.
Yeah, or I think there was one, excuse me, one point where they actually sent him on a, they were cutting up the pad on that particular day, and then he realized later they had sent him off on a wild goose chase, and he got to wherever he was going and realized, hey, wait a second, yeah, this is bogus. Something is wrong with this picture. And later he found out that they just wanted him out of the way, you know, that type of thing. So, that's really, to the best of my knowledge, that's his, kind of connection with any mob type of work. You know, he was in motorcycle for a few years, and that was probably the happiest time of his life. You know, he loved motorcycle. He loved, you know, that Harley Super, the 1200 mm-hmm. Harley Super. And, you know, like a friend of his called me after he died, and he said, your father would even, you know, pay for his own gas because he loved it. He loved it, and he thought, you know, I'm so blessed to be on this motorcycle. And he said, the other thing is, motorcycle is clean. It's clean. And mm-hmm. I said, what do you mean clean? And he says, there's not the corruption you find in some of the other, you know, some of the other areas of, like patrol or detectives and stuff like that. So he loved it, and he was truly and you know, there's a picture of him, and maybe you've seen it, by his squad car.
Yep.
I mean, that says it all. I mean, that happiness that he had, he was, I think, the happiest in his whole NYPD career at that moment in motorcycle.
You highlighted the corruption a bit, you know, as you kind of grew up, got to speak with him, dive into that a little bit more. What was his feeling about kind of knowing that, you know, brothers at arms, those around him, you know, some were corrupted? Because I can tell just from the book, from the stories, from everything, you can tell he's such a stand-up person.
Yeah.
But a unique individual as well, where it's like, you can tell it doesn't have a judgmental side. He's very, he's by the book, but like what you're saying, that even the guys that were the bad guys liked him.
Sure, sure.
Did he ever speak to that, or, you know, his feeling about kind of that corruption that was happening?
Mm-hmm. I mean, he was obviously he was a straight cop. And during the 13th Division scandals, he came under investigation because he was part of that whole division. And he was exonerated. And, you know, it was actually his name came out in the newspaper, I think the Daily News, as one of three officers that was exonerated. You know, I think his attitude was, you're going to have rotten cops. You're going to have corrupt cops. Hopefully it's going to be just a minority of cops. I knew he wouldn't brook any of that nonsense. And he was, again, he was straight and his moral compass was, you couldn't question that. But I never heard him. If he talked to me, it was almost like those people that did that, I feel sorry for them, that they would have to do that. But there was never ever, a judgment, to beat them down or condemn them. I never heard that, but it was more like so sad. You know, these people, I don't know why they did that. And it's just a shame, So
you spoke about the Harlem riots happening, and that was kind of one of the first times that you really understood how serious, being an NYPD cop can be and can get very fast. Do you think that was the time where you started leaning towards the direction of a potential career working for, the federal government, and as we'll get into here soon?
Yeah.
Would you highlight that moment? Was there a different moment? Like when was the first time that desire started to pop up?
Yeah, that's interesting. Probably high school, college, I started to kind of, the seed started germinating for me. But at the same time, I was also interested in other things. For example, languages. I love Spanish and I loved studying languages and, actually had good relationships with my teachers. And so I thought, maybe teaching would be an interesting career for me. So it kind of, the law enforcement thing kind of was always there, but, I was also looking at going down other avenues and looking for maybe some other things that, might prove to be satisfying for me. And, I remember I said at one point, though, this was after college, I said, Dad, I'm thinking about maybe NYPD, he said, well, okay, that's good. But, you just went through college. I just paid for your college. And he said, why not the feds in a law enforcement role? Why NYPD? I mean, it's great. You like NYPD, but why not the feds? So that was another, that opened up another kind of a door to me to think about. And so I would say, after college and certainly after my teaching career, I said, okay, I'm all in law enforcement.
What's up, guys? Real quick, if you're enjoying the episode thus far, you can do me a huge favor and leave the video a like and subscribe. Or if you're on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, make sure to leave the podcast a 5-star review and follow so you don't miss any future episodes.
Yeah, I'm all in.
So let's dive into the teaching career, because like you said, this set the foundation for pretty much every gig that you had going forward. And, it was it's still very unique, but, especially at the time, it was a very unique place to be teaching, working, operating, and really having any type of experience there. Right. Most people still don't, but back then especially.
Yeah.
So highlight, what kind of got you into it? What got the ball rolling there? And then, why it was foundationally so important.
Well, it was interesting because after I graduated from college, back in 77, there wasn't really a lot out there to say. And then I didn't go about it very smartly anyway to kind of look for a career. I had this vague idea that I would go into teaching, and then that didn't work out initially. I didn't really have an organized way of looking for work. I had some money, and I ended up going back and forth into New York City every day. But I was, not organized, not with real purpose. And the only thing, it's funny, that whole summer that I was looking for work, the only thing I kind of liked was this one fella said, how would you like to work undercover for me? And I said, what do you mean? And he said, Well, you know, for example, you would, for example, well, we have, let's say, a construction company that's losing money due to theft or embezzlement. We would like you, we think you could go undercover. You would work in the construction, you know, listen to what's going on. And then at night, you go back to your hotel. This would be all over the States.
By yeah.
way. And then you would write up reports. And it kind of was fascinating, that idea, you know, undercover. But then I thought about it. I said, wait a second. Have you seen my hands? These aren't construction hands. They'll know immediately that I'm the snitch. And then, you know, then I thought about doing reports. You've already put in a full solid 8 to 10 hours of work with these dudes. And then you're going back to your hotel and writing a report. I mean, hey, you know, I'm a single guy. Can I look for a girlfriend? That yeah. type of thing. So that was really the only interesting thing I
was
thought.
Was it a private investigation?
It was an investigation company, and they would take me in, something
okay,
like that.
Cool.
And that's what I remember from that whole summer of looking for work and not really knowing what I wanted to do. So in the meantime, I'm a security guard over, you know, in Long Island somewhere. And I'm thinking, geez, I'm not, you know, I got to find something. And then, you know, out of nowhere, and again, I had seeded some of the schools in my area, my neighborhood, with my resume as maybe a Spanish teacher. And then I get this call, like maybe in January. Now, again, I've graduated in May. Now we're in January. And I get this call from these Christian brothers, these monks at a school called LaSalle Military Academy on Long Island. And they said, we're looking for a Spanish teacher like yesterday. Their Spanish teacher, something happened to him. I won't get into it, but just these quirks of life that, and so, you know, I said, okay, I'm your man. And then, you know, I go in there, I start teaching Spanish in this incredible school where, you know, the Americans, you know, this is an elite school, not only for Americans, but foreigners. So on the American kids, Willie Mays' son, the baseball player, he's there. And then you've got the mafia kids, all the five families, all of these kids, Gambinos and, you know, and the rest of them. And they're the grandchildren.
Oh,
and,
shit.
Yeah. So it was kind of interesting. And then foreigners, you had Somoza, and you know, Somoza from Nicaragua. Mm-hmm. His grandchildren were at the school. They were the Shah's relatives from Iran. So it was a really crazy, crazy school, great school.
And talk about diversity, man.
Yeah, and this was in the, I think, of the Singer Estate out there on Long Island. So it's a gorgeous place, yeah. Right? So I did that, and the monk said, hey, how about teaching English as a second language? Would you... and I'm like, yeah, you know, I'm Spanish. No, we need someone for these foreigners. And I said, really? Hey, well, look, here's what we'll do for you. We'll, you know, go to school, get some certificates, and we'll pay for that. And you'll get your certificates. And okay, well, if you're going to pay for it. So I did that in Stony Brook University. And I got some teaching certificates for English as a second language. So now, you know, I have my Spanish. Now I have ESL. And then that came the point where... you know, I ended up being offered a job in the Middle East after 2 years. And that only happened because of the English as a second language, the certificates I had gotten. Again, all of this is kind of random by luck and quirk and,
yeah,
you know, just interesting.
Couple steps.
Right. And so now I find myself, you know, October 1979, and I'm in Saudi Arabia. I'm in Riyadh. And I'm like, how did I get here? But, you know, I'm open to adventure and I'm open to learn. I'm a curious person. And I said, and besides, you know, living at home, you know, I want to be independent. I want to be my own man. So this was a perfect opportunity for me.
Going out to Riyadh though, man, that's
yeah,
it was getting away from home.
It sure was. I mean, of course, you know that Saudi Arabia is the most orthodox of all the Arab countries. And on top of that, where I was in Riyadh, I mean, this was the heart and soul of the Ikhwan, the brotherhood that kind of launched the kind of very sterile, very orthodox group of Arabs in Riyadh. So Riyadh was very, very tough. The coasts were a little more open, a little more friendly to foreigners, but Riyadh was austere. I mean, it was... However, you know, I'm at Riyadh schools. This is a school for the Saudi Arabian royal family. And wow, was that an eye-opener. You know, I'm with King Faisal's grandkids. And they said, Mr. Ken, you must come out to the palace. And there I am in the palace on weekends.
Saudi Arabia is
like in the...
Yeah, King Faisal's palace, which wasn't... It was a very modest palace, because if you know King Faisal and his background, he was a very modest guy, probably... And I came away meeting his children and his grandchildren. I came away with a lot of respect. Of course, he had been assassinated before I got there, maybe just a few years before I got there. But you could tell, talking to the grandkids and the kids, they had such a love for this man. And then when you looked at his palace... he didn't have to have them. I saw other princes that would have this, incredible, these digs like you wouldn't believe. And, they were throwing around money, pissing away money like you wouldn't believe, right? But, I ended up, I had Prince Turki, Prince Sultan, all of these people, I came to know. And, just how crazy this was. One day I'm walking down the street near my villa and I see this Rolls Royce coming down the street. And it's slowing, and I'm like, what's this? And it stops, and then the window comes down, and, hey, Mr. Ken, it's me, Saudi, Prince Saud.
Yeah.
This is the grand, one of the grandsons of King Faisal. And he's got a bucket of Kentucky Fried Chicken. He says, Mr. Ken, join me, have a chicken with me. And I'm like, okay, why not? So I jump in there, driving down the street in Riyadh. So, it was a fascinating glimpse into the royal family and petrodollars. It was quite in that country's history, it was just the seminal events going on and in the world.
How long did it take you to adjust to the culture there? I mean, you're coming from New York City, which is a freak show in its own, and I own that being New Jersey, New York guys. We understand how crazy it is,
right?
But Saudi Arabia is just its own domain as well. How long did it take you to adjust culturally there? Or were you able to kind of fit in quick, you feel like?
Yeah, I mean, I thought I kind of fit in pretty quickly. I'm that type of person. I'm kind of open to things. I mean, I worked with people that were not as open to things and, who had attitudes and stuff like that. But that could be anywhere. You'll see that. So for me, it was always the glasses half full. I was kind of optimistic. So it didn't, and again, if I could be there learning things like a language and customs and, the difference between Sunnis and Shiites and all the politics that was going on, because, I I'm there just a few weeks and it seemed like the whole world blew up. You had the Iranian hostage situation going on.
Yeah.
Like just a few weeks after I arrived, Mecca was taken by the Saudi rebels. And that whole situation, the siege of Mecca. So I'm living through all this stuff. And so it was a lot of stimulus going on. But also, I'm living and hanging out with expats on a great deal. So I'm with a lot of Brits, Aussies, and people from really all over the world. That was kind of I could be in the Arab world and then maybe on the weekends I could, get back into the Western world, because there were compounds, there were swimming pools, a lot of parties. I probably, to be honest with you, I probably partied more in Saudi Arabia, believe it or not, behind closed doors. Yeah, no, I know it sounds crazy, than I ever did in the States. It's kind of a funny thing because, you're in this austere place, land of sands, and then, we had religious police out there called Matawa.
They'd
go out there and rip, anything, if they saw like a chain or gold or anything, rip it off you. Or for women, if they had short skirts, they'd be, spray painting their knees in black, just to, to scare people. So, so that's going on. So then when you do get to be with the other Brits and nurses and things like that, you tend to kind of, you want to kind of enjoy yourself.
You guys were able to drink alcohol and stuff?
But, you had to be careful because there were people that were actually making their own booze and then trafficking in booze. And that's, one fellow I knew, he went to prison. He escaped prison and ended up writing a book about his escape. But that's another story. That's in my next book.
Yeah, we'll talk about that offline.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, alcohol there is still there. I don't know if you've seen recently, it's Riyadh season where they've become like the Mecca for fighting. So
right.
Like boxing,
right.
MMA and everything.
Right.
And it's becoming a huge push in the country right now for those fights to sell alcohol because people are coming from all over the world to watch fights in Riyadh.
Right.
A beer with a boxing match is pretty nice.
Yeah.
But it's seeing a lot of controversy.
It's haram. It's prohibited. I understand that. But yeah.
So at any point, did you ever feel like you were in danger being in that region?
There was one episode, and again, it's in my upcoming book called Land of Sand, where I actually feared for my life at one time. It was two Irishmen and a Filipino, myself, four of us. We decided to take like a day trip out to the empty quarter. And when I say empty quarter, that's that huge thing of sand out there. It's like like the Gobi Desert. Not actually on the fringes of it. So you could kind of look out and say, wow, I saw the empty quarter, right? All these British, from the 19th century, these guys would cross the empty quarter. Some would make it, some didn't. Mm-hmm. So I remember we went to a town called Layla, and I pretty much got us into a real pickle because, we went to some store there, kind of small little grocery store, just to pick up provisions and, juices and, it's hot. The environment is pretty hot. And then I was wearing a cross. It was dangling out of my shirt. And some of the fundamentalists, the old timers with the long beards, white beards, they came out and I thought they were coming out to be friendly. And so one guy starts babbling. I said, what is he talking about? The other guy says, you are Christian. And now there's like a group, now six people, the old guys babbling are all like it was, I walked into a beehive. And I said, yes, I'm Christian. And they said, no good, haram, haram. And so more people came and then all of a sudden people started throwing rocks at us. And then it got really out of hand. And at one point they had one of their police cars came over. I remember a swarthy little guy with a beret, and he says, oh, Mr. You must leave now. You get out of here. They will kill you. And so we actually kind of run out of town. Like literally, we got to run out of this town, get back to our vehicle, and then take off like bats out of hell. That was probably the only time where I felt threatened. Like, we could have been harmed.
I mean, I'd be freaking out if I was in that situation too. I can imagine.
Yeah, but that's the attitude you would find in Saudi Arabia. Some of it, some of the people were so brainwashed, even down to some of the kids, where Christianity is haram. We don't go there. Islam is the religion. That is the true religion. And you're insulting me if you wear a thing. So I learned how to tuck it in, and if I wanted to stay there and live with these people.
Yeah, I had an interesting conversation with that guy we were talking about, Taylor. He has a very interesting outlook on all that. We don't have to dive too much into it, but it's definitely, what you're saying there. It's interesting when you get to the extremes of any religion where you see that that conflict come.
Yeah.
Usually when it's funny, when the teachings say to be friendly with everyone, to be, open.
And I'll just give you one small example here. I had a third grade class. So I had, this school was grade 3 to 12. But I had, this was my only kind of elementary school class, like a third grade class. And so, and I'm to blame for this. I didn't do the preparation correctly on that day. I wanted to talk to the students about what you might see in America or in Britain, a little town. And so I had a little kind of... not a map, but so it's like a poster, and it has a typical town, with the market. With what I didn't, when I unfurled it, I didn't even see it. There was a church on the poster, right? There was a school, a bank, all that, and there was a church. So no sooner do I unfurl the poster, and we're going to talk about it, then again, this beehive, kids start going crazy, like, what's going on? And this one kid bolts out of his seat, runs past me to the poster, and he spits on the poster, with the glob hitting the church, and he's screaming haram, haram, like Dracula, seeing
third grade
garlic or something, right? Yeah, third grade, and so you realize how ingrained they're taught to, at the time, some of them took it to another level. They hated anything to do with any other religion but their own. But again, this was kind of, it was rare, but it did happen.
Yeah, and Riyadh, I mean, it's a really interesting country because there's still so much fundamentalism there, but it's also entering the more, you know, kind of modern Western type of ideals. You see that with a lot of the Middle Eastern countries, and it's like, and, you know, you go outside of Riyadh, it's still a lot of what you were highlighting, you know, very fundamental.
Yes.
But Riyadh's starting to turn the corner a lot. It's,
you know, I heard that, Connor, and it was just like last year, my wife and I were in Long Island. We're at a hotel there. I'm on my, we're doing our 50th high school reunion, staying at this hotel. We run into a Saudi couple, young Saudi couple, a fella, the wife and their kid. And so we're like, oh, we start speaking Arabic. We're, you know, chit-chatting in Arabic. And then my wife and I start saying, hey, is it still like that? Are you still wearing the veils and covered, you know, from head to, and they're like, no, we don't have it. And did you know, and then I said, did you know that, really, that happened? I'm like, dude, we lived it.
Yeah,
my wife and I, my wife worked for the Saudi Arabian Airlines. So, and that's how we met. But we just couldn't believe. And they were telling us, oh, no, now we can do different things. And, you know, this this haram concept is, you know, we're progressing. We're coming into the world. And I'm thinking to myself, good for you.
Yeah.
That you didn't have to, you know, grow up during that. It was totally different.
Yeah, that's what I've seen that as well. And it's still the same deal where it's like, you know, if you do whatever you do here and you go to the deep south, you get a little bit of weird looks.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same there where it's like Riyadh's pretty open, but if you leave Riyadh, then, you know, you get some.
You get to some of the small towns, yeah. I would imagine, right?
Yeah,
I would imagine.
So let's start getting into, you know, moving towards the FBI. Like I said, I mean, we were able to just kill a bunch of time just talking about it right there. You just had one of the most unique experiences very few Americans ever get now, but especially back then. And it becomes increasingly relevant, you know, as you start progressing, you know, through federal agencies and stuff. So, you know, when was the first contact in terms of starting to look towards taking a path towards the FBI?
Sure, sure thing. So I came out, we came out of Saudi Arabia and I thought, you know, I have a master's in liberal studies, but I thought, you know, it'd be maybe wise to get an MBA. And, you know, I had saved up some money from our time in Saudi Arabia. So I got accepted at Columbia in New York and then the Thunderbird School of Global Management in Arizona. So I opted for, you know, the Thunderbird School in Arizona. You know, I got my MBA there. And then when I graduated, well, during that time, of course, Thunderbird is a school that attracts people that go into foreign business, overseas business. So we were regularly visited by people from the CIA, would come looking for students that have been overseas, learned languages. You know, these are the type of people they wanted to recruit. So we would see people from the CIA, people from the FBI. And during that time, I met a Mormon, Paul Mortensen, a Mormon FBI agent. And he was talking about the FBI, and I went to listen to him. And then after his speech, you know, we talked kind of on the side of the room, and he said, hey, FBI, you know, you'll never get rich as an FBI agent, but you'll never be poor. Yeah. And he said, yeah, we could, you know, you speak Spanish, you're bilingual in Spanish, you claim to speak basic Arabic, you're taking Arabic now at the school and Middle East courses, which I did. And he said, yeah, we'd like to have someone like you. And your father was law enforcement. Hey, you know, so that's when I started to, you know, I put in an application and, you know, those things. And because I had been in overseas for many years, the application took a long time to kind of come back to where they contacted me.
So I was going to, yeah, we'll get full circle on that. So in the in-between there, you started working banking, correct? And you were...
Yes, 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 that's right. So while I'm waiting for this thing to happen with the FBI, maybe it happens, maybe not, I got recruited by Manufacturers Hanover Trust in New York, Manny Hanny, to work in the correspondent banking with Middle East accounts because of my background.
Mm-hmm.
And I soon realized that this was not really my thing. You know, it was... you know, finance and just, and I thought, boy, this is really not me. I mean, it was great to have bankers' lunches with people from the Middle East and, you know, you're talking about assets and, you know, liabilities and all the banking in between. But I soon realized it wasn't me.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. You know, it's just one of the, I'm looking at the people around me, I'm looking at the work, and I'm saying, this really doesn't stimulate me. If I do stay here, it won't be long. I can just tell. And I don't want to be hanging around in a job where, you know, kind of not enjoying it. So I think that kind of even stimulated me more to pursue this law enforcement option.
So was FBI in the back of your head that whole time where you're kind of like, let's get here, come on.
No, it was. I mean, I was reading everything I could. I'm a voracious reader, and I was reading every FBI book out there. So I was seriously considering it for sure, yeah.
So they turn the corner, they come. And like you said, I mean, like I talking with Tom previously, I mean, and unsurprisingly, the FBI doesn't miss anything. They go through every bit of person's history. They want to know everything,
right,
which makes sense. Right. And of course, you were in one of the hottest spots in the world, not only then, but
yeah,
as you go out through your career. So unsurprisingly, they have to do tons of background checks, but the corner turns. You get that initial offer to come in, to start working, progressing towards becoming an agent. What was the feeling at that time?
Joy. So happy. And, you know, Manny Hanny didn't like it. I remember, right? My boss, Larry, says, you know, hey, Strange, come here. He walks me to the window, and we see like a drug deal taking on Park Avenue. Little drug dealer goes, that's what you're going to be doing. I'm like, okay, but I'll be happy to.
Yeah.
But he was kind of cynical about it. But I was pretty happy to get in.
Was there any nerves or feeling like, was there any second guessing yourself when that situation presented it?
No, not at all. You know, keep in mind that I entered the Bureau when I was 34. So I was almost at the cutoff age of 35. So really, I'm kind of an older candidate. And my classmates, you know, they were kind of early 30s, late 20s. So I had a little more experience than most. So I wasn't really nervous about it. I said, hey, let's do it. Let's get it on. And, you know, there were a lot of things happening in the Middle East, and that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to get back in this game and maybe help my country and make a difference.
Did you, with that, and, you know, speaks to your story later, but was there a preference of staying in the U.S. or were you looking to maybe go back to the Middle East, or you're kind of good with whatever?
Yeah, it didn't matter. I mean, if my work was based in the U.S., fine. If it was overseas, even better, because that stimulates me more interesting, even more so.
So let's jump to Quantico, because the way that you brought out the message of being there and everything was really awesome. I actually really liked how the story was told, you know, through and through. So, you know, you're heading to Quantico. What's the mindset going in? I mean, like you highlighted, you know, you had more experience, but we're at an older age than a lot of the agents. And then, you know, you get hit with some of the physical tests first and you're kind of facing, you know, some, maybe a former SEAL or Green Beret who's just pumping out like it's nothing. So what was the mindset there?
Yeah, the mindset was, you know, I'm with younger people who are in better shape than I am. And I deluded myself because I could run a mile and a half, although you had to run 2 miles.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, I'm running a mile and a half and thinking, okay, you know, I can do this. And not even trying to think about the you know, I didn't practice push. You did what you're good at, and you did it well. So push ups, sit ups, no problem. But pull ups, I hated them, and so I didn't even practice on them. So you know, just that type of thing. And you know, these people were much fitter than I was, and it was very obvious during that first test.
So yeah, dive into that first test, because this sets the stage for. It's a really important message that I think that the story arc that goes through.
Right.
So can you highlight that first test, kind of what happened and I guess how it set the stage for the way you developed throughout those couple weeks at Quantico?
Yeah. So I went in, looking back, I was unprepared physically for what was ahead of me. So, and it, you know, very quickly. I think one of the first things we had, one of the first exercises, was the pull-up. And I, you know, like I said, I hate pull-ups. You had to do a minimum of one or two, something like that. And I couldn't even do one. I jumped up and I kind of, I guess it's cheating. I just, you know, with the whole, I jumped up and then with that whole motion, I would go over the bar, one. And I'm thinking, okay, all right, I did the
We're
one.
Good to go.
And then, you know, I come back down and I'm like, everything is burning. You know, you know, it's tough for tall guys, by the way. And so the instructor says, zero. And I'm like, and loud. And everyone's looking like, oh, damn. And no. And I said, why? No, you have to hang on the bar and then pull up, not in one motion. So now, oh my God, you know, I'm already defeated mentally. So I jump back up and now I'm like, you know, and you know where that's going.
Yeah.
Zero. So right there, you know, I'm not qualifying. And then the 2 mile run was, you know, again, these people went out. There was some rabbits that went out there pretty quickly. You know, one guy, yeah. I mean, he runs track in college. I mean, that's his thing. So, you know, I'm halfway through and he's finishing.
Yeah.
That really blew my mind. So, yeah, I was devastated. And then at the end, they come in, they say, there's a few of you going to remedial, physical fitness, and strange, you're one of them. So I'm like, yeah, geez, you know, and I got to do better than this. And now, you know, this career could be on the line, my law enforcement career. And so this is very serious. And fortunately, Connor, you know, they had these sessions for us, extra sessions, which were very helpful. But I even went beyond that. And I think part of it was because of pride. In my book, I mentioned two of the other classmates had those comments about me, you know, and it was.
Can you detail what those were?
Yeah. So. I just remember one of them said, hey, strange, too many bankers' lunches in New York. That I think that was one of them. And then the other, his friend, kind of jumped in there too, and the snickering. And, you know, so I seized on that. And you know what? They were right. And they can, of course, why not say that? But I seized on it and I said, screw them. I'm going to use this as fuel. And I'm going to get better, and I'm going to beat you two on that final test, and that's what I lived for. I was doing the remedial sessions, but at night, you know, I do my studying, but then I would hit these trails at night, and I'd go out there and just, you know, my breath is, the frost is coming out, right? One time I ran through like a hostage rescue. They were doing a thing with a helicopter out there at night. I'm going by these helicopters and searchlights and the whole thing. And I'm thinking, I'm going to get them. It was just this, I'm going to beat them. And that hung with me for the whole, I think it was 12 weeks.
So in the moment you highlight in the book, when those, and I feel like anybody would feel like this, you know, you're getting shit talked to, you're kind of like, screw those guys. And, you know, you obviously have like a level of contempt. Looking back on that now, for the way that it pushed you,
yeah.
And I feel for a lot of people, you know, they usually don't take it too well, but you took it very well. And you said, I'm gonna get mine. Do you look back on that with like almost like a thankful attitude, being like, thank you for?
I do. Absolutely. Those two guys, they did me a favor. Mm-hmm. They really did. And both of them subsequently went on to great careers. You know, one guy, I think, headed up the Madoff case. And the other guy did great things on the West Coast. So, you know, some of it is pride. Some of it's a little bit of immaturity on my part. But yeah, no, I'm thankful those guys did that. And then one of the other guys kind of picking me up. I ran out of gas that last half lap. And I couldn't go. And I was fighting it mentally. And then this one guy said, Strange, come with me. Let's do it. And then somehow, you know, you found the reserves and you went in. And I said, wow, this is really about teamwork, teammates that can inspire you to finish. It's not just me. It's, you know, helping your fellow agent.
Yeah, I was going to actually get to that. So, you go for it all on that last day to get your revenge. And I can
I know from personal experience as well. If you send it on a run and the lactic acids take over and you're like, oh my God, it is one of the most painful things that you can have.
It was. And I was retching at the end of the run.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just nothing coming out.
All stomach acid. Yeah.
Exactly.
So you have a fellow agent or soon to be agent come pick you up and say, we got this.
I'll never forget him. Love the guy.
What was his name?
Eric.
Yeah. So Eric picks you up, pulls you through. And like you said, this fundamentally changed the way that you kind of view the FBI, the team, yeah. Quantico.
Right.
Can you speak to what that impact was on you and, you know, how it made you look at fellow agents, you know, fellow coworkers, everything moving forward?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it just made me realize that it wasn't about me. You know, it was about the team. You know, and we could help each other, like this guy Eric showed me. So, I mean, it just changed my mindset. I was grateful for that, and I wanted to make sure that during my career, I would help people as well. I mean, that's the way it should work. So, it dawned on me during that experience at that particular moment, this is bigger than me. You know, prior to that, it was all about me. It kind of, is that narcissistic? Egotistical, but that's when I decided to change.
So before we leave Quantico, you know, you're highlighting all these late night runs on the trails, and I've been there myself. There's moments where, especially if you're running, you know, it's freezing cold outside, mm-hmm. and you're like, this sucks. Yeah. Was there ever a moment, and I'd love to ask this question, where you were second guessing yourself, or maybe right on the edge, where you're like, I don't know if this was for me, and if so, how did you break out of that?
I'd have to answer no. I'd never felt that way. I felt I was in the right place, only because, again, I had experience. I had a teaching career, then I had a short banking career, and now I was here. And I said, "This is where law enforcement is where I should be." You know, this is where I should be. So I've never really second guessed that, to be honest with you.
Yeah. No, I mean that's awesome because that's kind of what you want. You want that mindset. And I always say, you know, I think the second guessing for you potentially would have been those guys talking shit.
Yeah.
And, you know, people need that type of kick in the butt at times because
sure.
you could take it the wrong way, which is like, man, you know, maybe they're right.
Yeah.
Or you can end up like, you know, yourself running on the trails at night saying.
It was some motivation for me.
Yeah. So you graduate through and you're ending up going to Newark, New Jersey. So one of the most beautiful places on the planet.
I didn't want to go there. I didn't and I remember when they handed out the assignments, I was like, huh? Now I'm living in New Jersey. So, you know, hey, that's not bad. You're near your house. But I think New York was higher. You know, they received more money in New York because of standard living there. So for me, the New York office was kind of the flagship. You know, it had such a reputation. There was so much going on in that office. So I just thought, oh, you know, I'm from New York. New York, it's me. But, I'm glad I didn't go to New York.
Yeah, ended up having quite the career there in Newark, New Jersey. And I guess the highlight, so you ended up first coming in for as the application group, right? And then you moved to...
Well, you know, I immediately went on to the JTTF.
Okay, so that's where you jumped right to it.
Right to that. And again, according to my boss at the time, that shouldn't have happened. And he was not really happy with me coming aboard. He thought that I should, you know, make my bones with the applicant squad and spend a year or two, you know, just going around interviewing people.
Is that pretty normal for like hazing, quote unquote, but like, you know, slow entry?
Yeah. I mean, you know, if, you know, my boss was a little different, you know, I didn't have run-ins with him, but he, you know, he would kind of little comments would let you know how he felt.
Mm-hmm. So can you explain real quick what the JTTF is? Just, there's going to be tons of acronyms today. So, you know, yeah. we might have to highlight them here sure. or there.
Yeah. The Joint Terrorism Task Force.
Yeah. And then, so real quick as well, so you highlight this unit is C-10.
C-10 was our squad designation. I remember we were next to C-9. They were the Foreign Counterintelligence people that worked on spy matters, Russian, Chinese, North Korean, East Germany at the time, right? So C-10 was the Joint Terrorism Task Force, and it was quite a diverse group of men and women.
So just real quick highlighting, so like the C labeling, so C-9, C-10, so that those are all just different squads with different objectives within the FBI. So that's kind of just a different labeling if you're going from C7 or whatever it might be.
Yeah. I mean, we were co-located on that floor with the fugitive squad. I forget their C designation. Above us, there was a white collar squad. There was a drug squad. All of them were the C something or other, but ours was C10. Yeah.
So you're joining the Joint Terrorist Task Force, and that's like one of the premier teams in one of the premier areas.
Wow, lucky guy.
Yeah, what's the feeling there? What's your mindset?
Astounding. I mean, this is where I want to be.
Yeah.
You know, this is, you know, my background. Everything up to this point, just I'm where I should be. But I knew, seeing these men and women, I knew I had to be at my A game and really, really work hard because they were experienced and they were, you know, they worked hard. They were professionals. And I admired just about all of them.
Yeah. You highlighted that. So what did the makeup of the C-10 squad look like in terms of the different individuals there and kind of stacking yourself up against the team?
Yeah. I mean, we had, of course, FBI agents, but we also had we had New Jersey state troopers. We had a few state troopers. We had a Secret Service agent on board. And then we had kind of this... loose affiliation. There'd be one agent from INS, Office of Investigations, and then that person would come on later formally to join the team, but he was always around as well. So we had that type of diversity, you know, in that regard. And then, you know, we had men and women as well. I remember we had a fellow from India. We had a fellow from China as well. Diaz was our Cuban intelligence guy. He was from Puerto Rico. I thought it was diverse, pretty diverse.
Yeah, no, that's, it seems like it's such a cool squad makeup as well too, because again, like you're coming from different variants of backgrounds, but you're jumping full on to the ship and you get to see.
You got to move because
the best of the best.
Yeah, you know, these things are moving, you know, you're like jumping onto this kind of walkway that's in motion. I remember two things that really hit me. It was, and I call it the candy store of terrorism. I mean, there was so many groups operating in our area. I just couldn't believe it. From, you know, the PLO and Abu Nidal down to Sikh, Indian Sikh terrorism, Jewish Defense League, and then even on the domestic side, our squad was still involved in this the murder of that New Jersey State Trooper Werner. And, you know, so we were still chasing some of the Black Liberation Army people. Joanne Chesimar had escaped jail and was in Cuba, but we were still following up on leads to those people as well. So that was domestic terrorism. But most of what I did ended up being Middle East terrorism because of my background.
Yeah. So jumping into one of the first cases you ended up doing, or, you know, operations or work that you had, you got loaned out to the C9 group. This one is so interesting because it's like, it's something out of a movie.
Yeah.
So if you want to detail the story, but yes, you get transitioned for one of the, in your first few weeks, transitioned to a case for C9, which was the counterintelligence group. Right. So can you highlight that case and the individual behind it and everything?
Yeah, I just, you know, of course, you're the new guy. So if other squads are short, they're going to call the new guy and you go wherever you needed, whether it's, you know, to sit on wires and listen to Colombia money launderers, which I did for a while, or participate in doing some translations in this undercover operation. I did the translations and we arrested a public official in Newark. But, you know, all of a sudden we had the supervisor from C9 say, hey, I need another body. We have this Soviet defector and we need people to kind of watch him. And so it was out in the boonies somewhere, maybe pretty close to Pennsylvania or something like that. But so I showed up. I became one of these agents safeguarding our Soviet defector. And he was an interesting cat.
Yeah, Nikolai.
Yes.
Perfect name too. Yes. Such a Russian name.
Yes, yes. Boy, was he interesting. And he had a background with apparently Spetsnaz.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what was your, I mean, you highlight this pretty well in the book as well. You know, you walk up to the safe house and you see this Nikolai individual walk out. You've been briefed that, you know, he was KGB, Spetsnaz. Mm-hmm. Maybe if you could highlight what those groups are, if people don't really understand the gravity of those, two titles. But what was your first reaction seeing this individual?
He was such a handsome guy. He was handsome, well-dressed, very educated, almost haughty, you know. But I think that was just the way he came across. And I spent time with him, so he would open up, and he turned out to be a very interesting guy. We engaged in some great conversations with him, but you know, he had some problems.
Yeah,
alcohol was one of them.
Can you highlight real quick what KGB and Spetsnaz is, and why this individual required a safe house? Why he was pretty important?
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, he was working with the Russian intelligence services, and I think KGB is the overseas part of it. And so I think his cover was maybe a journalist, something, or maybe a trade association guy. I forget. But he came over and he decided, he wanted to join the good guys. And so when that happens, you do everything you can to protect him, you know, verify who he is and what he's doing. But also to protect them, because, you know, at the time the rivalry was so big with the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And this was just before the wall, or right about at the same time. But there was still this rivalry, Cold War rivalry. So anytime you could pick up a defector, or the Soviets could get one of our own people like Ames or Hansen, you know, that was a big thing. So this was quite a, kudos to C9 that they were able to flip this guy and bring him in.
So you're still like a pretty rookie age. And at this point as well, you know, what were your first interactions with Nikolai? And I guess, how did that start shifting your perspective at all, or kind of impact you?
Yeah. Let me just back up. You asked me about Spetsnaz.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's an elite force that the Russians have. I guess it's equivalent to our Green Beret or SEALs or something like that. Apparently he claimed he was with a Spetsnaz group, and then he actually described a firefight that he had been involved in Afghanistan, and it was freaking blew my socks off. And this guy, he was explaining it, he wasn't there. He was back in the cave, telling me.
Can you explain the firefight?
Oh, just like to the death. I mean, these were grenades going off. These were people slitting other people's throats. People in agony. He's watching his own people die. He's killing people. It was unbelievable. It was blood-curdling stuff. And, you know, I'll never forget it.
And he had pretty severe PTSD. That was one of the issues.
I mean, I'm not a doctor, but I'm pretty sure that that's PTSD. And then, you know, alcohol didn't help.
Did that shift your outlook on, how did that impact you, I guess, on your, you know, seeing an individual like this? And, you know, you're working the operations at this point. Just how much is up there.
Well, you know, I'm doing my job, and my job was simply to safeguard the guy and to babysit him. But we did a few things together, which are in the book. Mm-hmm. And you know, you get to know someone. You spend that amount of time with the person, and you get to see his personality, and he opens up. You know, we actually became, I wouldn't say close friends, but we became friends. And I looked upon him, you know, he was in a tough position. He had left his family in the Soviet Union. So I knew he had a wife and a child, maybe two. I think he had one child. So he had given that up. And, you know, my goodness, when would he see those people again? And then, you know, he had basically, he was a traitor to his country. So, I felt bad for him on that level. He was under a lot of stress. But I I liked him. And, you know, he was helping our country. Mm-hmm. Which was great.
Yeah, and I mean, again, it's one of those really interesting ideas where, you know, you're a new agent, you're kind of looking at, it's a perspective that most people are never going to get when they get to see the turmoil that someone might go through, and like mm-hmm. the mental battle just to you know, he's betraying a nation, joining another. And then, you know, you get these stories with this guy where he was in conflict in Afghanistan, you know, in a cave. And it's like, it's very humanizing, I would imagine.
Yeah. And, you know, the ironic part and maybe the tragedy, aside from his death, is the fact that everything he was giving us was going right to the Russians, back to the Russians, because of this guy Hansen, one of our own.
Yeah, can you explain?
So that's my understanding. This was another FBI agent that worked in that arena for many years, and he rose through the ranks, Robert Hansen, who became, in the end, out of greed or whatever, became a spy for the Soviets. So, you know, everything, my understanding is everything we were getting from defectors, you know, he knew all about it. And he would just go back to the Russians and say, hey, guess what? They got Nikolai, and he's giving X, Y, and Z to the, just so you know. And that's a tragedy. A tragedy.
Was it weird seeing that kind of cat and mouse gameplay? Because, you know, you're part of the C-10 group, which is investigating kind of terrorist, looking at operations happening in the U.S. directly. And now you get to see that kind of, you know, cat and mouse game that tends to be counterintelligence. Was that interesting?
Well, to be honest with you, I didn't spend a lot of time in the counterintelligence field. I mean, I just, you know, that wasn't my my silo or bailiwick. You know, mine was kind of this, you know, intelligence gathering and cultivating informants, Middle East. That was my thing.
Yeah. No, I was just for, you know, the couple of weeks you're spending there, it was probably funny to see, like, you know, you're going and all of a sudden you're seeing this ping pong match, you're like, geez.
No. I mean, look, I mean, I'm a voracious reader. I knew what was going on. I knew that my former supervisor was involved in the Danilov case, and then he was traded for these other people, and they were on a bridge walking back and forth as they're trading. Yeah, all of that spy craft that went on, I mean, I was aware of it, what was going on, and I just kind of, I would look across my desk, and I'd see these guys at their desk, and you know.
Yeah, go get them.
Yeah, I knew what they were doing, you know, which is great. But, you know, we had our own jobs. But,
No,
it was magic. It was incredible.
So let's dive into that. So, you know, you get to go back to the original operations that you moved in for with the JTTF. What were the first, you know, couple months there, some of the initial operations that, you know, you started taking centerfold in?
Well, you know, I remember I had a kind of a training agent for a few weeks, one of the fantastic guy. And he had done some work in Lockerbie, and he was a German speaker, and he was just a very meticulous agent. So I'd go out with him. I mean, you know, we didn't have iPhones or anything like that. We'd have these books with maps that we'd get around New Jersey. He had all that stuff, and he had his pads, his writing. He was always prepared. You know, he was the perfect agent to me. And so I didn't spend a lot of time with him because we just didn't have the luxury of, you know, training a new guy. You know, you had to get up to speed pretty quickly. But I remember going out with him several times. You know, one of them was, I think, was a Libyan. We're looking for a Libyan guy. We could never find him. And you know, there were other cases. So he showed me the ropes. And then I remember the first time that I kind of went out solo was checking an alleged IRA member in New Jersey. And then that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, what was the case there? Can you explain real quick what the IRA is, though, just for people that might not know?
Yeah, the Irish Republican Army. I mean, they, you know, this was deemed a terrorist group that was in a war at the time with the Brits, with the United Kingdom. So it was a war involving, you know, murder, shooting, killing, you know, the Troubles over there. So it was... you know, it was pretty serious stuff. And so this was an allegation that this guy had been involved in the murder of, I think it was a British army captain or something like that. So again, and my job was to kind of, you know, they'd find a person and then they'd say, okay, you know, flesh this guy out, find out everything about him, you know, from soup to nuts. What's his phone number? Where does he live? Where are his friends? All these things. And so at the end of all that, then you actually go out and, you know, this is part of a preliminary inquiry. Then you go out and you talk, you actually interview that person and then come back and decide, you know, is there enough to go on to a full investigation, or do you close it out and just put it in the files and just keep your, you know, keep your ears open. So that's what happened with this guy.
Mm-hmm. Was this your first interview with the individual?
Yes. Yes, it was.
What was the feeling going into that?
I was nervous.
Yeah.
because I don't know who's on the other side of that door. You know, I mean, I have an idea, but you just never know. Right. But, I spent time with him. He was, very guarded. He was very tight-lipped. He was very nervous. And I got the impression from him, although I didn't have any evidence, that he was involved in some way, shape, or form with this murder. But I couldn't prove anything. I mean, he denied all of that. So that was my first. And that's when I thought, I like this work. And here is this game of cat and mouse that he's kind of playing with me. And then just out of the corner of my eye, you know, he's denying, I know nothing about that. I know nothing about that. No. And then I saw a book on his mantle, something like The Troubles or Ireland at War or mm-hmm. something like that. And I said, you know, check that out. And, you know, oh, you're not supposed to see that. Mm. Don't look over there. And then I thought, this guy he's bullshitting me, but I don't have any evidence, so can't prove anything. But it just kind of whetted my appetite for that type of work.
Yeah. I mean, that's what it's all about, feeling that justice and everything. Was there a fear, kind of a thought of like being in the room with a potential killer as well? Because, you know, you hadn't crossed paths with that type of entity yet too. I mean, was there any feeling with that?
Not in this particular case, right away his body language was, you're in control. I'm scared shitless, but I'm not going to give up anything. I'm not going to give up my mates for you. But not in that, only until he opened the door, then, you know, it sunk in. Okay, I'm going to live to fight another day.
Yeah.
The only time I thought, and maybe I was paranoid, was a Palestinian guy. I was in his apartment, and this guy was, he was a sociopath, I remember he hated the United States, hated the president, because he told me, said America's weak and all that. And then he actually had contacts with Saddam Hussein. And so was sitting watching a video, because he was in Baghdad, and he decided, and that's the strange thing with these people. And again, maybe this is where I'm coming from. I'm a great listener. And I am empathetic. So, you know, these people would, for some reason, they would trust you and start talking to you and be themselves. And in this case, this guy became a lunatic. And I thought, keep your gun here, because he just started, he got so worked up over a video that he was showing about Saddam Hussein. I thought, Mother Jesus Christ. This guy is wacko. And you know what? Watch your six here, dude.
Yeah.
You know, I'm thinking, and my friend, my partner said, hey, you know, and we had beepers at the time. He said, hey, I want to be kept up. You go. I know where you're going. So I told him where I was going. But that was the only time I was uneasy about getting out of his apartment.
Was that the Bush assassination plot? Or
no, that was the, that chapter is...
I'm trying.
Crow's nest.
What,
right.
What
this one. This one here is.
Is it El Said?
Masood.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I got no background in the Arabic language, so the names, man. Were just,
yeah. No. That's scary. That's okay. But you know, he had an American name. That was his Arabic name.
Yeah.
But he was totally bogus. I mean, on the surface, he was this immigrant who spoke English very well. He was classy, knowledgeable. He was the like the assistant country manager of some golf, some country club in the area. And he was snowing one of our people. I mean, snowing him, just giving. Oh, I can tell
can
you.
Can you describe what snowing is?
Yeah, what I'm saying is he was providing information, but it was useless information. It was about the Iranians and, he was a Ba'athist, the party of Saddam Hussein. He was one of these Palestinians that was, you know, been born in Iraq and joined the party, and was a fanatical supporter of that regime, fanatical. And then when I saw the tape, the videotape, when you're sitting next to Saddam Hussein, huh? How does that work? You know, and you're telling one of my other agents, oh, I can tell you some stuff about Iran. No, dude,
this is what we want.
Yeah, you're not coming clean. So that's when I discovered, I saw right through the guy. I saw right through the bullshit. And, I was lucky. I had some help with the informants who could watch and talk his language and tell us the real story of what was going on.
Can you break down further that real story and I guess what the relationship ended up moving from? You know, he was giving you information about Iran, and then you're like, hey, buddy.
Yeah, yeah.
You got all the information about Saddam Hussein. Let's go.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, in the end, I said, I know who you are. And, you know, and then I was discovering things. I mean, he had ties to this little splinter group from the PLO called the Arab Liberation Front. I mean, these were serious people. This was another terrorist group. And, you know, I noticed that he was playing footsies with them. And then prior to the Gulf War, he's going back and forth. Oh, you know, and we had a lot of sources going on, and you know, he's going back to, and he would say, "Oh, I'm going to Amman, Jordan." No, you aren't. You're going to Amman, and then you're going to Baghdad, but you have a mission, dude. And that's when we found out he was doing stuff. He was, you know, scoping things out, whipping things up. It was all for Saddam Hussein.
What was Saddam looking for at that point? Or like, what was he trying to get out of this individual?
Look, they were looking for all kinds of scientific centrifuges. Nuclear type stuff, all kinds of things, computers, paint, everything imaginable. And, you know, and this kid was the contact with all the different groups to foment, you know, subversion. But again, we were on him like flies too, you know.
So we're going to take a quick break here, stretch our legs. But when we get back, we'll dive into why there's so much happening right now with Saddam Hussein and stuff in the 90s and why it comes to a boiling point. But we'll get back to that. We'll do a quick stretch our legs.
Sounds good.
I hope you guys did enjoy part one. And if you did, remember to hit the subscribe button because part two is coming out later this week. In part two, we deep dive everything about Ken being on the anti-terrorist task force, including meeting one of the bombers of the World Trade Center in the early 90s, as well as diving into his time working down in Juarez, dealing with the Juarez cartel, and meeting some of the most notorious cartel bosses ever seen. So if that sounds interesting, make sure to hit that subscribe button or follow button if you're on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And with that, I'll see you in the next one.